EcoWatch and TakePart.com on various facets of the connection between our personal health and our total health environment, and that's what we discuss every week on Connect the Dots. I'm here with you every week to speak with different authors, advocates, experts, scientists, researchers, and ordinary folks who are connecting the dots in various ways between our personal health and our total health environment. We also feature actions on the show often, but today we won't be doing that. My guest, who I'd like to welcome to the show, it has written a book on the rise of the U.S. environmental health movement. What could be more apropos for Connect the Dots? Her name is Kate Davies, and she's been active in environmental health issues for over 35 years in both the United States and Canada, has worked with a number of non-governmental and governmental organizations, including Greenpeace, the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, and a whole host of others, and she's currently a core faculty member at Antioch University's Seattle Center for Creative Change, as well as a clinical associate professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Washington. So there are many, many, many themes that we frequently discuss here on Connect the Dots, and it's great to have you with us, Kate Davies, to probe into some of them. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let me just begin by kind of tossing you, I'm sure for you it won't be a challenging question, but it's kind of a place, I think, to start. But maybe it is. You do discuss it in your book somewhat. Yesterday, I do a lot of social media posting on Facebook on my page, Connecting the Dots for Health, as well as elsewhere. And yesterday there were two stories that either one of them would have been very concerning, and taken together, both in one day, it really was kind of shocking. And yet, it's really hard to even process things of this enormity. Let me just read out to you and our listeners what we're talking about here. The Huffington Post had an article announcing that scientists monitoring global levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide have found that for the first time in human history, CO2 levels, and these are the concentrations that increase global warming and climate change, could very soon rise above 400 parts per million. Regular listeners to our show know the organization 350.org. I featured a number of Bill McKibben and others from that organization. I featured many, many of their terrific actions. And, of course, 350 refers to the optimal level that we don't want to go beyond in order to trigger uncontrollable climate change. That's why there's been so much activity on the Keystone XL pipeline, which would take us over that edge, and here we are heading there in any case. So that's story number one. Story number two, New York Times, flow of tainted water is latest crisis at Japanese nuclear plant. Again, this is the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant that has, you know, been in a stage of, you know, crisis really since March 2011. We just passed the two-year anniversary. A quote from the article, "The water keeps increasing every minute, no matter whether we sleep, eat, or work," said Masayuki Ono, a general manager with TEPCO who acts as a company spokesman. He said, "It feels like we are constantly being chased, but we are doing our best to stay a step in front." Now, you're not supposed to ever pause for dead air on a radio program like this, but, you know, this is an ongoing emergency is what he's signaling, and I think his statement, "We feel like we are constantly being chased, but we are doing our best to stay a step in front," really applies as well to the environmental movement that you write about in your new book. And it, you know, we're kind of aware of a number of different things happening on multiple fronts. We're trying to take action for that. And yet there are many people who kind of view these very concerns as background noise. So as someone who, you know, has recently written a book about this movement and who's been active in the movement for as long as you have, I, you know, apologize for this long introduction, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to ask a question that I know is in the minds of many listeners and one that I often ponder, which is, you know, with this level of challenge going on in our environment, with these kinds of threats to health and the human life systems here on Earth, how do we, you know, what is the, how do people respond? How do we in the environmental movement respond? And how do we help other people face up to these kinds of risks?
Well, I think that's a great question, Allison. It may be a long one, but I think it's just a terrific question to get started with. And I think what the environmental health movement has been doing is trying to put a human face on some of the issues that you mentioned, like climate change, for example, like toxic chemicals, like radioactive waste. I think the environmental movement has been absolutely doing its best to do what it can, and it's been using the environmental movement makes its arguments largely in scientific terms, and it must do that because that's what the basis of policy, or it's supposedly the basis of policy. What the environmental health movement does is not only does it use the best science, but it also foregrounds human health. It shines a spotlight, if you like, on the health effects of what we're doing to the environment. So it shines a spotlight on how environmental quality affects our health and our children's health. And by doing that, it really makes the issues a lot more personal and real and immediate to people, and more urgent to people. And so by doing that, the movement over its 35-year existence has been relatively successful. Now you may say, well, where's the evidence of its success? Well, the environmental health movement has so far been working largely at the state and local level in this country, because federal politics have been so gridlocked since the 1980s, basically. And at the state and local levels that this movement has deliberately chosen to work at, it's been relatively successful. Over 900 different state and local ordinances were either proposed or passed roughly in the 1990s. Even in the last 10 years or so, we've seen almost 20 states pass almost 100 state laws on toxic chemicals and other hazardous substances, mostly with bipartisan support. This is an amazing record given what's going on inside the Beltway, the Washington, D.C. Beltway. So, yes, we still have a huge way to go, and yes, we still hear a lot of bad news every day, but I think that the more we can make these issues, these really huge and overwhelming issues, as you point out, the more we can make them kind of real and immediate to people, then the more likely we are to achieve the changes that we're all hoping for.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, after the Fukushima incident, there were families and moms, people from the area who came over from Japan and kind
exactly.
of did a tour, and that would be an example of
that's
the kind
exactly
of thing.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yes, mm-hmm. very much mm-hmm. so. You know, and mm-hmm. the other way that we're seeing this, particularly with climate change, is, of course, we're seeing an increasing severe weather events in this country. You know, we just have to mm-hmm. think about Sandy and mm-hmm. the 6-month anniversary that happened yesterday. Those types of disasters, horrible and tragic as they are, help us to see that that climate change is real. Now, I'm not, you know, you can say, well, Sandy wasn't caused by climate change, but there's certainly evidence to suggest that there's an association there. The more we can actually see and hear the victims of environmental disasters, whether it's Fukushima or Sandy in this country or last summer's drought in this country, the more likely we are to pass the very difficult legislation that we need to solve climate change and, mm-hmm. and other issues too.
You know, it's an interesting thing, and I've often wondered, I don't know if you've looked into this, but you know, we have created, you know, this vast technological society. We enjoy many benefits from it. At least in the West we do. Some people do. Maybe not everyone, but a lot of people do. A lot of the people who are part of the group that, you know, is kind of sharing information and influencing opinion and enacting decision-making would certainly be part of that group. Are we wired neurologically to look at these kinds of things? Because, you know, when you say we have to base our arguments on science, I completely agree, you know, as a health reporter and, you know, always have to do that and have been doing that and sort of trained to do that for years because that kind of gives a certain kind of credibility. But on the other hand, what you're speaking to is this, and that's kind of left brain linear argument.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's, you know, there's our actual sense of being, our neurology, or other aspects of who we are. And what you're hinting at there is that there are opportunities to engage those aspects.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Certainly, no, my background is in science, so I'm not saying dump the science at all.
Mm-hmm.
And to be quite honest, we've never had as much scientific information as we have right now showing that our health is being harmed. We've got buckets of scientific information showing that our health is being harmed by environmental quality. But what I'm suggesting is that as well as using all that science and making it accessible to everyone, we also need to look at the human side of this dimension. And that can mm-hmm. be pretty scary. You know,
mm-hmm.
it really can, and I want to acknowledge that. It can be pretty difficult to look at it. But if we can, to the extent that we can, And very importantly, to begin to ask the question, what should we do? You know, policy is supposedly based on science, and science really doesn't deal with the question of what should we do in this situation? What is the ethical response?
Mm-hmm.
What's the compassionate response? What's the moral response to climate change? And that's what the environmental health movement does. It raises that question.
Mm-hmm.
It says, what should we do in this situation? And that part of policy is rarely, rarely talked about these days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's really an important point. You know, let's step back for a second and just, you know, because I think there's both, as you said, more science than we've ever had before, but there are also gaps in the science as
right.
well. You know,
right.
and there are policy reasons both for, you know,
right.
a lot of these things we're seeing and for the scientific gaps. In other words, the same agencies that are too weak or too disinclined to regulate are also too weak or too disinclined or too underfunded to study. So could you kind of highlight what some of the most recent telling findings that you regard as significant are, and then after, you know, you've kind of shared that with our listeners, we can then kind of loop back and say where we would like to see more science to fill in the gaps.
Absolutely. So what I'd like to do actually is talk about, so what do we know? At the mega level of environmental health, what do we know about how our health is affected by the environment? Well, as I said, it's actually quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
According to the World Health Organization, for example, nearly one quarter of all human disease is linked to poor environmental quality. Let me repeat that because it's such a stunning figure. One quarter of all human illness is linked to poor environmental quality. For kids, the proportion is even higher. It's about one-third, and this is on a global level, one-third of kids' illnesses are linked to environmental quality. That's just one piece of information. Related to that, we know the World Health Organization says that almost half of all asthma is caused by poor air quality. About 20%, one-fifth of all cancers, and about 15% of all heart disease are caused by environmental quality. Those are really, that's a huge, huge, huge burden of disease. And what makes this all the more tragic is that a lot of it could be prevented. You know, if we cleaned up the environment, made sure that people had access to sanitation and clean drinking water and weren't exposed to toxic chemicals, a lot of that burden of disease could be prevented. That's huge. And then think about the costs of that. Think about all of the costs for those environmentally related diseases. This isn't just a health issue. It's also a huge economic issue. In this country alone, we spend about $3.5 billion a year on environmentally related diseases and disabilities. That's a big piece of change. We also know, moving back to some of the science, we also know that about 180 different diseases and disabilities are associated with environmental contaminants. Everything from, I've mentioned asthma, many different types of cancer, birth defects, reproductive problems, and developmental and learning disabilities in kids. 180 different diseases. You talked about climate change a minute ago. Right now, globally, we've got about 300,000 people a year are dying from climate change right now. And it seriously affects another 325 million people. These are staggering, staggering numbers. In the U.S., we know that about one in four Americans lives within 4 miles of a Superfund site. Mm. Almost half the U.S. population lives in a county that exceeds one or more of the national air quality standards. Hmm. So, you know, this is scientific information that's readily available to anyone who has access to the internet. Mm-hmm. And it really shows what the burden of environmental disease is in this country. It's an epidemic here, you know, and yet we're not aware of that when it's not really common knowledge that our health is being so much affected by the environment.
Mm-hmm. You know, sort of two things come to mind. One thing I think is that, you know, when someone gets a bad diagnosis, they are just suddenly in an acute situation. They're running toward treatment. You know, they're desperate for whatever could help. And yet there's a complete kind of no man's zone where everything is fine before there and we don't know how we got there.
Yeah.
You know, I often, you know, having written about natural health and integrative medicine and you know, self-care and all of that, you know, obviously, I mean, there are some people who have very strong constitutions, they could abuse them, and then, you know, they're kind of unaware that they're doing so, and it seems like their body could take anything. Suddenly they have a problem, you know.
Right.
There are other people right. who have more delicate constitutions and may either be, you know, sort of struggling earlier, but not really arrive at, you know, the personal health solutions that would redress these kinds of exposures and problems, because we don't really have a lot, at least conventional medicine doesn't, on the treatment end until you get to, you know, the stage of illness where we then have these acute treatments. And on the integrative side of the spectrum, there is more diagnostics and testing and monitoring of body, you know, function and status along the way. But that's also very costly. It's not built into the healthcare system. And again, you know, unless people are having a health problem, they may not investigate those options. They may not have the wherewithal to pay for those options. And they may then, again, arrive at unexplained illnesses and then, you know, just kind of be given pharmaceutical drugs or other acute treatments. You know, my perspective on health comes about through, you know, decades of investigation, actually, of more advanced integrative treatments that do check functional status all along the way. You know, but very few people are, you know, obviously have the financial wherewithal to do that or aware that it even exists. Even the proponents of natural health who emphasize eating a healthy diet or whatever, which certainly is a good idea and foundational and, you know, highly recommended. I do it myself and everything. You know, even that may increase resilience, but it's not clear at all that it will make anyone immune from, you know, these waves of ongoing exposures that we don't monitor. I mean, we don't monitor them in terms of, you know, levels of what is in the environment very well, and we don't monitor them in our bodies. So, you know, the connection, you know, we see this statistic that, you mentioned,
right,
for example, about the rising cancer rates, but it has no, but it doesn't, there's no way where it meets that challenge that you posed at the beginning of the program of are being able to trace it to ourselves. Even if we see that rate, even if a loved one gets cancer, at that moment you're in, you know, an acute crisis. And until you're in that moment, there's a huge disconnect. And,
right. Yeah, that there is. I absolutely agree. And the key to this is prevention. The key to this is prevention. So we don't get to those acute moments of crisis. You know, we can all, and I hope we all do, eat a healthy diet and minimize our exposure to toxic chemicals and do whatever we can. And absolutely, we should do that. And that doesn't eliminate our exposures because these things are in the air that we breathe, in the water we drink, even if we drink, you know, bottled water or purified water. It's everywhere. It's in our food. You know, you get about 95% of your exposure to persistent toxic chemicals through the food you eat. And sure, eating organic can make a difference to that, but it doesn't eliminate it.
No.
Because they're in the air and they fall on the crops and get taken up into the crops. So as much as individual action is a great thing, and I do encourage it, what is going to deal with the epidemic of environmentally related diseases is prevention. And prevention requires strong policies. It requires strong policies at the state level, the national level, and strong, effective international agreements to make sure that this stuff doesn't get out into the environment anymore and that we clean up the messes that we've created. So what I'm calling for is individual action, yes, but more importantly than that, we need government action. We need strong policies to do this. And this is where the environmental health movement has really focused. It's at the policy level. It's at the level of prevention. And sure, you know, when you get that acute, when you get that diagnosis, and a lot of people are in the environmental health movement because they've had that diagnosis or they know someone who's had that diagnosis. You know, the reason that I joined the movement is because my mother was diagnosed with 3 forms of cancer in her lifetime with no apparent reason for that, not in the family history or anything. Mm-hmm. And that motivated me to join the environmental health movement 35 years ago. So those are common experiences. And as well as responding to those diagnoses and doing whatever the treatment options are, hopefully health, you know, reasonably integrative ones or complementary ones, then we also need to advocate for strong policies to prevent this from happening to other people. You know, and the groups that have been affected by environmentally related diseases are really prominent in the environmental health movement. I'll name the Breast Cancer Fund, for example, out of California.
I just actually, it's so funny you mentioned them. I'm working on a blog right now for Take Part about, you know, just basic, you know, beauty care products, moisturizer, deodorant, very basic ones.
Exactly.
And I've just been, you know, looking at their report today.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know,
they're a great organization, you know, and who are they comprised of? They are comprised of people who have been either breast cancer survivors or family members or friends of people that have breast cancer. And not only are they, you know, working to minimize their own exposures, they're also lobbying very, very hard for policies to reduce everyone's exposure. This is a public health issue as well as an individual health issue. That's the point I want to make.
That's a very important point to make. And in fact, we've got another few minutes before we break for our kind of halfway point, station identification. And I want to talk a lot more about public health, the public health context for all of this, you know, in the second half of the show. So we'll be, you know, we're kind of heading right there because, you know, it seems like there's kind of a lack of awareness or lack of engagement around public health, and I think it's an important thing to discuss. I was speaking with someone who is very much in the forefront of, you know, promoting healthy diet, veganism, not that I'm a proponent of that specifically, you know, or any specific form of diet as the one or anything. But basically they were saying, well, you know, all of this, these different environmental health risks that we've discussed are just the kind of, you know, entry fee for participating and being part of, you know, a technologically advanced society. And if we enjoy the benefits, these are some of the downsides. And I think part of the problem is that when people are younger, unless they are experiencing, you know, personal health effects, which of course are happening, you know, there's an increase in breast cancer incidence among younger young women, young adults, also people's children, you know, there's a great incidence of childhood cancers, developmental delays, you know, if it shows up in one's children, then suddenly people have the aha wake-up call like what you're describing. But you know, if that doesn't happen, then typically it isn't until midlife that people, you know, some of this other stuff catches up and, you know, we either oneself or people we know, such that, you know, we're aware of these connections. And so there's a whole kind of opportunity period of people in, you know, the early prime adulthood where they kind of, unless they're hit by one of these things, they kind of sail along and don't really see, they don't know the price tag till they get to it kind of thing. So, I mean, that's just been my observation. And, you know, I think it's really important to educate people younger because that's when prevention can best happen, obviously.
Love your thoughts on that. I absolutely agree with that. I couldn't agree more, particularly as young people, you know, particularly young women, have very significant exposures through beauty products and cosmetics. I mean, we all do. But when I think about, you know, everything that I did when I was, you know, a teenager and in my 20s, I have no doubt that my exposures through personal care products, you know, through nail varnish and makeup and soap and deodorant and all of the things that we all have in our closets, or most of us at any rate.
Yes, I'll raise my hand there too.
are really significant. So I absolutely agree we need to reach the young people. And there's some interesting work happening right now looking at environmental health across the whole lifespan. So looking at the effects right through from conception and birth right through to old age, and pointing out the difference, how the risks and exposures change over the lifespan, which is really interesting work. But I think you're absolutely right. We certainly need to do much more education and work with younger people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you were about to, we sort of got tucked in with the breast cancer fund. You were going to mention some other useful organizations, which I'm sure our listeners would love to hear. So I'd love to hear what other ones you really, you know, admire and recommend people look into.
Well, in terms of, you know, health of groups that have been affected by environmentally related diseases, I'd mention the Collaborative on Health and Environment. This is, it's an international organization, but it's based here in the U.S., and the Collaborative on Health and Environment really tries to not only translate the latest scientific information on how our health is affected by environmental quality, but it also is a great networking resource on all sorts of different environmental health issues and concerns. And their website is, if you just look up Collaborative on Health and Environment, You'll find them, and they have monthly conference calls that are free, and all sorts of other resources that I highly recommend. I also, in the book, there's a whole list of resources in an appendix for all of many of the big environmental health groups in this country. There's basically environmental health groups in every single state and every town. In the U.S.
Let me just mention for our listeners, the book that we're talking about is The Rise of the U.S. Environmental Health Movement. It's by our guest today, Kate Davies. It has a foreword by Elise Miller, who is with Collaborative on Health and the Environment, and a past guest on Connects the Dots. Look into our archives, listeners, for that terrific program where we're speaking with her about similar and interrelated issues. And we are now going to head into our break for station identification. Please stay with us, listeners, for the second half of the show with Kate Davies talking about environmental health. If you have anyone that you think would be interested, now is the time to Twitter them or tweet them or write them a note on Facebook to listen to our show. You can get to at http://prnfm. Coming up to the station break now, and then we'll be back in the second half to speak more with Kate Davies about some of these issues. I always love these kinds of conversations because you also work with students, do you not?
Oh, very much so, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my regular day job is I teach in a graduate program at Antioch University in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we're called the Center for Creative Change, and we offer graduate degrees in we help prepare people to become leaders in social change wherever they are, in their organizations, in their communities,
That's
if
fantastic.
They're working for nonprofits.
We have to get some tips for you about that for our audience here. That would be great. Okay, we're gonna break now, and we'll be back. Stay with us. Come back for the second half of the show with Kate Davies. I'm Allison Rose Levy here on Connect the Dots. Stay with us, listeners. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, health, food, and environmental journalist and hostess of this program. We're here on Progressive Radio every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. So tune in and also check out our archives where we have another number of interesting programs and speakers about all the ways that our personal health connects to our total health environment. On today's show, I am talking with Kate Davies. She is the author of The Rise of the U.S. Environmental Health Movement, and we're discussing, she's been involved in this for over 35 years, and we're discussing all of the facets of this terrific topic. Past programs that I would recommend for you, if you're interested in this specifically, is a recent program we did with Dan Fagan, the author of a terrific book on Toms River, which was an environmental health nexus site and a place, a cancer hotspot, very sadly, and he documents all of that in his wonderful recent book. We also had Elise Miller of Collaborative on Health and the Environment, with us last summer, and check out that show in our archives. If you've missed the first half of the program with Kate Davies, you can also look for the show there, and sign up with me on Facebook on Connecting the Dots for Health or on my website, healthjournalistblog.com, to receive announcements of upcoming programs. Now back to our conversation with Kate Davies. Kate, one of the things that you were saying in the first half of our program, you use the term public health. Mm-hmm. And, I have been, we live on opposite coasts and everything, and so here on the East Coast, as my regular listeners know, I've been very, very involved in the fracking issue, and uh-huh. specifically, with the concerns that fracking chemicals, heavy metals, radioactivity, radon, other things that are associated with that process, really could have a very damaging effect on both the water supply, the air quality, and the sustainable food shed of New York City, Philadelphia, and other major northeastern urban centers. And I've been reporting on that issue since 2009 on the Huffington Post, Alternet, and now EcoWatch. you know, with those concerns specifically. In fact, it became a big wake-up call for me and shifted a lot of my reporting down that road. But the thing that's really been just kind of come up belatedly in considerations of whether or not fracking should proceed or could safely proceed, which I don't believe is actually possible given the degree of compliance by the companies and muscle by the regulators, not to mention scientific problems in doing it. But, you know, but the debate really has only recently kind of slowed down around the issue of public health and the concerns over public health that this process poses. And yet up until maybe just, three or four months ago or really back in the fall, and I covered this on Huffington, has the debate really opened up, and this is after several years of consideration of a whole range of different things about fracking, has a health conversation around it really opened up? And, you know, there's a complete lack or absence of studies. It's not the only instance where we have a product or a process where there's no studies. You know, my question is, where is public health here? You know, we have a whole bunch of doctors looking, you know, at individual health treatments. We have healthcare systems looking at that. We have research dedicated to that. But who is looking into and out for public health, where we have mass health risks being incurred? Whose domain is that? Yeah. Where are they? What is the status of that?
Yeah. That's a great question, and fracking is a huge problem. Fracking is really bringing the issue of environmental health right into the kitchens and the living rooms of this country. And in my book, I talk a fair amount about how and why fracking is doing that. And you're absolutely right. The public health voice hasn't been very prominent in the fracking debate, and should be more prominent. This is exactly what I'm saying in the book, is that we need more of a health voice in some of these debates. I mean, thankfully, there are people like Sandra Steingraber raising these issues and being willing to go to jail for them, which I think is just remarkable. I think the nature of the debate is changing, but we definitely need to get public health agencies behind us on the anti-fracking movement, and I think they are beginning to move. You know, organizations like the American Public Health Association, for example, their environment section, and state public health associations. But public health has a lot of public health is still dominated in this country by the more traditional concerns that public health has always had of, you know, restaurant inspections, swimming pool inspections, garbage complaints, that kind of thing. So we really need to bring public health institutions into the 21st century and point out that there are now new threats to environmental health caused by toxic chemicals, and fracking in particular is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're describing, you know, the hygienic concerns and all of that, it actually, that is obviously, that's important, you know, can't be discounted, but it actually reminds me, there's almost a parallel there because, you know, initially conventional medicine early on in the, you know, first half or, you know, first 50 or 60 years of the 20th century, for example, you know, was really concerned with infectious disease. And in third world countries, you know, some of the improvements we've seen in, you know, in health outcomes and longevity have occurred due to better sanitation methods and all of that. So there's many gains through, you know, modern hygienic standards and protocols being, you know, kind of followed.
Exactly.
You know, so we can't discount that. But at the same time, in both more civilized countries that, you know, where we're consuming all these products as well as having the environmental exposures that are kind of shared globally from industrial outputs and everything. You know, we're seeing these health downturns. And in fact, I was talking with someone recently who said to me, oh, well, they heard someone on a morning TV program saying, oh, well, you know, longevity is upticking internationally because of these kinds of measures. Meanwhile, in the U.S., it's projected to decline because of, some of the man-made choices, you know, that we're doing, both in terms of the food that people are eating and also in terms of these toxic exposures. And so there's, you know, you get one talking point and then everyone's reassured that all is well, when in fact that really isn't so. So really what you're describing is a very backward public health scenario there in terms of today's reality.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that you know, in the early part of the 20th century, there was a huge decline in communicable diseases in this country, and that was due to the public health movement, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, basically, we have most environmentally transmitted communicable diseases under control because of the work of the public health agencies in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But now, what we see is a huge uptick, as you say, in chronic diseases like cancer, like asthma, like learning and developmental disabilities in kids. These are chronic conditions that can last a lifetime, and as I said earlier, can be largely prevented. So now what we need is a much more effective public health response to those chronic conditions. And in the book, I describe that whole process of how we went from how the public health movement successfully controlled all of the communicable diseases that were killing people, often kids in under the age of five, and now how we need a much more effective system to look at preventing chronic diseases like cancer and so on that I've mentioned already.
What can the average person do about this? I mean, you know, like, where are public health officials even accessible?
Well, there are public health officials, you know, in every state and town in this country,
mm-hmm.
And they need to be pressured, I think, to think more seriously about preventing some of these longer term diseases that we're talking about, you know, and also lobbying state legislatures. I mean, by all means, we also need to take the individual actions that you mentioned earlier, and I don't want to gloss over those, but in addition to that, we need to support groups that are lobbying state legislatures for tougher chemical regulations in this country. You can find out about those. There's a website called Safer Chemicals that is a national coalition of states that are really taking action on toxic chemicals at the state level. You know, there's about 20 states this year, more than 20 states, that have that are looking at legislation in their legislative sessions that are either underway right now or just finishing. That's a huge number of states, and all
that
of
is.
This work is being coordinated at a
I think
national
it's
level.
Really interesting point. Actually, we featured the head of the National Coalition Safer Chemicals on Connect the Dots twice, and also presented with him at Green Festival about a year ago. So, you know, listeners can learn more about that as well by going to their website or, you know, tuning into these previous programs. But, you know, the thing that you mentioned, it's really interesting that Safer, and I think it bears highlighting, Safer Chemicals was initially trying to act on the federal level in order to get the federal government via the EPA, you know, to sort of change its legislation, because these chemicals, many people are shocked to discover it, but about 80,000 chemicals are in use without ever having really been, with only a very small percentage of them having been ever studied for safety. And this is because, you know, with all of the rah-rah, we hate the government, that's, you know, been a kind of growing and perhaps orchestrated movement, you know, we've sort of undermined, the protective organizations like the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, from being able to kind of have the mandate and the budget to really protect us. And so as a result, we're not protected. And when Safer Chemicals tried to go that route and get laws passed and everything, there was massive pushback from the American Chemistry Council. So now which really kind of blocked the passage of the bill, even as it was ready to go forward and finally begin to study these things. So now the fight has gone to the state level. And, you know, I think on fracking, certainly in the Northeast region, you know, many people are now much more aware of speaking up to state and local governments than ever before. But, you know, I think for many people, they might have gone a lifetime and never once, appealed to their governor or their state legislature for anything whatsoever. So this represents a new form of stepping up that, you know, people kind of really need to think about. What would you have to say to someone who has never done this before?
I would say do it. Do it if you care about the health of your kids, the health of your friends, the health of your family. We need to engage in our democracy. Mm-hmm. If we let the laws be written by the corporations and by the lobbying associations that represent the corporations, then that's really sad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's more than just showing up to vote once every mm-hmm. 4 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. We really need to engage as citizens, and whatever that takes, whether that means writing a letter to your senator, your congressman, whether that means showing up in your state legislature, whether it means going to a demonstration, whatever it means, this is more than just minimizing our own exposure, although that is important. We also need to take collective action. And this is what we learn from the social movements of the past, and this is what's in my book, is what are the strategies for collective action? How is it that social movements, and in particular this environmental health movement, works to be effective? What are the strategies that it's using? You know, and there's lots of different things that we can do. You know, I'm thinking of all the municipalities that are passing fracking bans right now, mm-hmm. and ordinances. It's great. This is exactly what we need, and we can all get involved with local politics. You know, yes, it does take time, and a lot of us don't have a lot of time. But even writing a letter, you know, taking half an hour, it helps. It really does. We need to be engaged in our democracy, and, mm-hmm. and that's one of the messages in the book that I'm hoping to send, is we really need to be active citizens and not let the policies be written by corporations.
Mhm. 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 I mean, how, you know, we are both kind of in a nexus of, you know, I'm sure in our own work and lives, of people who are, you know, aware and doing this. And, of course, in the media, I am constantly, you know, communicating these kinds of messages and all the, you know, kind of science and everything we right. know that kind of backs them up. Taking a step back and looking at the big picture, which is something that you do so superbly in your book, which I just want to give another plug to so people can find it on Amazon and go out and get it, The Rise of the U.S. Environmental Health Movement, one of the things that you do, Kate Davies, is really, you know, kind of look out at the big picture. How well do you think we're doing in engaging more people in doing this?
I think that we are doing well because when people get proposals for fracking, or here on the West Coast there's, you know, huge proposals to build new coal export terminals. Huge issue here on the West Coast, or the Keystone XL pipeline, as you mentioned earlier. When we get these developments in our own neighborhoods, or we find out that there's a contaminated site in our neighborhood, then people stand up and pay attention and they take action. So the more that we find out about these things, the more that we become aware of what is going on in our own localities, then and there's more and more stuff happening. You know, if it's not a fracking proposal, it's a proposal for, you know, a hog farming operation, or you know, a new rail line to move coal to China. You know, which is say what we've got here. And those things are coming up with increasing frequency. So the more that those come up, and the more that people realize that they are affected, then the more people will stand up and take action. And I think that's what we are seeing. We're seeing it right now with fracking. You know, there's a mass citizens movement around fracking, as you say, that is beginning to emerge in this country. As we see more extreme weather events like Hurricane Sandy or like the drought last summer, people are saying, looks like climate change is real. Looks like, you know, we're being affected by it. You know, whether it's my farm not being able to, I'm not growing crops, whether it's whatever it is. And that is making people take action. It's when they realize that they are personally affected by what we're doing to the environment. That's a fundamental point I'm trying to make in this book, is when we realize we're personally affected, and more of us are now being personally affected. That will take action. So I am optimistic. I am hopeful.
That's very helpful. And I think another message that we can all take away from that is, you know, one of the things that used to happen was that there was, you know, everyone had an entree point through whatever issue they were concerned about, whatever it might be. And they were kind of, and we, you know, very often organizations, advocacy groups fight for limited funding, or for it to be the voice of around a certain issue. You know, human beings are human beings and everything. And so it's kind of my issue versus your issue. No, my issue is more important. And I think the other thing that we see through this growing movement is that whatever your entree point issue is, you know, you can be active on your issue and also see through and beyond that issue to other bigger issues of which, you know, we're all a part. Like, for example, I mean, it used to be that people, even in the environmental movement, first thought, well, fracking is okay because then we'll cut down on nuclear power, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now we're kind of like, no, you know, none of this is really very good. It's not an either or. It's either coal or fracking is okay. And we're looking to the bigger issue of climate change. So I think that, you know, whatever the issue, you know, I'd encourage that people espouse their issue, but realize also take action on the bigger issues that we're all part of, and realize you're part of a greater whole. So we're coming down to, you know, the final minutes of our program here. I just want to thank you so much, Kate Davies, for being with us. Urge readers and listeners to go out and get your book, The Rise of the U.S. Environmental Health Movement. Is there a particular website that you would like to send people to?
Yes, I have a website that has more information about the book. It also has a list of environmental health resources that you're most welcome to take advantage of. The website is www.environmentalhealthmovement.org.
Fantastic. So that's environmentalhealthmovement.org.
With
really
no,
great.
No spaces between the
No,
words.
That's fine. Well, thank you so much, Kate Davies, for being with me today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been great having you, and thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for another show with you. Check out the archives, and if you've enjoyed this program, like it on iTunes and pass it along to your friends. Thank you for being with us. I'll see you next week on Connect the Dots here on Progressive Radio. I'm Allison Rose Leafy.
Oh,